Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Today is something of a treble whammy, if such expressions exist. Since not only is it the Saturday evening, time for the regular weekly Dhamma talk, but also it's the new moon night, and so the time for the regular Dhamma talk. And today was also the annual Upasika renewal day. And so it's a particular day that we peg out during the year, part of the Upasika program, the lay people's training practice program, to make a refreshment of one's commitment to the refuges, the precepts, and to a particular standard of daily practice and going on retreats and acquainting oneself in a more in-depth way with the teachings. So this is an unusually potent day, a day of many blessings. Sometimes I think of the Upasika renewal day, which is something that a custom or a tradition that we started in this country. It's almost like a counterpart to the Katina festival that we have at the end of the year after the rains retreat is finished. Because just as the Katina festival, when the lay community come and bring material offerings to help support the monastic community, offerings of cloth and other things that the monastery needs, dye, duct tape, rakes, blank CDs, and you name it. This great plethora of offerings are made. So, but the Katina day is seen as a time of a celebration of the relationship between the monastic community and the lay community, and therefore it's really a celebration of the what's known as the fourfold assembly or the fourfold family of the Buddha: the community of nuns and monks, the community of lay women, lay men, the four folds of the fourfold assembly, and that coming together around the material needs of the monastery and then the lay community gathering its resources and making offerings. That's the manner in which that celebration takes shape. But as I was pondering this event today, the Upasika Renewal Day, and even though the title is the Upasika Renewal Day, in a sense it's also the Sangha Renewal Day. It's like a, because we exist as a symbiotic unit. There's a symbiotic relationship between the monastic community and the lay community, with which the Buddha established right from the very, very beginning, that we as a monastery can't survive without the goodwill and generosity of the lay community. We can't do anything. We can't sell anything. We can't grow food. We can't ask for food. And everything that you see around us, every element of this building that we're sitting in, has been donated as a gift of one kind or another to the community. The carpet that you're sitting on, the mats that you're sitting on, the mat that I'm sitting on, even the microphone I'm talking into, all these things have been donated. They've come from the generosity of the heart. So it's a day to recollect that sense of relatedness, and it's a day particularly for the lay community. Many people have come from far and wide, some from a whole large group from Oregon. Others have come from the East Coast, from North Carolina, or from Wisconsin, from Canada, come here during the week and particularly gathered here today. Also local people, those from Redwood Valley and this district, yeah, from far and near. To renew that commitment, so it's particularly set up to renew the commitment to the refuges, to the precepts. But that isn't just something that exists in isolation, because it's the strengthening of commitment and of a refreshing of one's understanding and enthusiasm for the practice, one's reverence for the triple gem, for Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. And that reinvigoration of one's intent as for the lay community, that also involves the monastic community, that we hold the ceremony here at the monastery. This is like the gas station. You can come and, you know, if you want to fill up the tank, the best place to go is the gas station. You don't go to the public library or to the pizza parlor or to the park. You know, if you need gas in the vehicle, then the gas station is where you go. So for that reinvigoration or that renewal, that strengthening of commitment to the triple gem, that strengthening of one's faith in the teachings, in the practice, and in the qualities of generosity, virtue, meditation, wisdom. This is the, you know, at least the monastery is designed to be a gas station. It's designed to be a resource for those kinds of qualities, where people can draw upon that and be inspired. And so the greater strength and faith that there is in the lay community, then that has a direct and immediate effect on the monastic community. Because we are all in this together. We exist in this interrelated state. So, in a way, as the katina is a particular boost for the monastic community on the material side, then the upasaka renewal day is a boost for the lay community, particularly in the side of the practice of sila, of virtue, and the practice of meditation, and in terms of the Dhamma teachings, the Buddha's teachings themselves. So, it's a it occurred to me that it's a very appropriate and beautiful counterpoint. And when we think about renewal or being freshened up or invigorated or improving ourselves, you know, things are getting better, I'm improving, I'm more committed, I feel like a Buddhist again. I feel sort of refreshed or renewed or reinvigorated. It's, you know, that maybe some of you do live in very remote places and don't have a chance to meet together much with like-minded people, and coming together today or those of you who've been here during the week might feel, oh, this is great, I'm really back on track and this is marvelous, and spending time with my Dhamma companions, Sahadhammikas, like-minded spiritual friends, this is great. And so that quality of renewal or invigoration or development, that strength of commitment, it's very tangible, it's very real for us, isn't it? And certainly many of the teachings point towards putting effort into cultivating that kind of encouragement, encouraging ourselves or being a good example to encourage others. But as with all things, and this is part of the genius of the Buddha in reflecting on this, if we look at it, then if we just focus upon improvement or development or strengthening something as an end in itself, if we take that to be the whole story, then and we're not paying attention to how we pick that up, then our very efforts to be committed or to be a Buddhist or to be strengthened, to be right now, I'm really going to keep the five precepts now. It's been 5 hours already and I haven't broken a single one. Great, so far so good, you know. We had at 1 o'clock, we had people who took the 5 precepts and the refuges then, so we might think we're doing great. Actually, it's 7 hours, nearly 8 hours already. So this is a part of the brilliance of the Buddha's teaching that I've come to appreciate more and more over the years, is that the subtlety of approach that he has, and that and the teachings point to over and over again, that how easy it is for us to take things for granted or take things at a superficial level. And so that we can so easily take the idea of improvement or commitment and then and not notice that we're grasping that in a way that's going to cause degeneration and confinement, entrapment, imprisonment rather than liberation, rather than a genuine development. A number of years ago when end of 1991, which is 17 years ago now, gee, long time ago, at the end of 91, when we were planning to open up a branch monastery here in California in the spring of the following year. The idea was in May of 1992, we were going to find a place in San Francisco and open up a branch monastery here in California, centered there. And I had my name was on the ticket to lead this adventure. Ajahn Pasana wasn't in the picture at that point. He was still abbot at Wat Nanachat and hadn't expressed any interest in this project. We hadn't really, maybe it hadn't even arisen in his mind then, but so at the end of 1991, it all looked like things were going to happen here, and that I was going to be having to take responsibility to open up a new branch, a new monastery here. And so that all seemed like a good development, and there was a lot of enthusiasm and good energy here in the community in the U.S. and California in particular. And in the flush of enthusiasm for that and the getting things together for the project, I was asked to write an article, make a little booklet to explain the project to people in here in the States or in Britain and wherever about what we were planning, you know, this new monastery here in the States. And as I was thinking about this and looking at it, considering also that, you know, I'd been a monk for about 12 years or so, and I'd been helping out at Amaravati, our main monastery in England, for quite a few years, and had been assisting Ajahn Sumedho, and had been very much in the role of always helping, and always been like sort of second or third monk, and always backing people up, and now I was going to be launched out of the nest to see if I could flap on my own, and to lead something, and to be taking charge, or to be in the role of that kind of role of responsibility. So it looked like there was development, or there was a sort of a new stage in my own practice, or was going to be demanded of me, and that I was going to have to grow up. And I couldn't rely on being sort of safely tucked down in position number 2 or 3. You know, you got a bit of buffering, and there's a bit of buffering. And so I was looking at this as a kind of coming of age. Like, okay, I'm no longer a teenager. I can vote now. I can get conscripted. So I better get my mind around that. And so that was the kind of thinking, or the framework of thoughts in my mind. And that it was holding it in terms of a maturation, or a greater commitment, or a greater responsibility. But then I noticed as those sort of thoughts took shape in my mind, or I pondered the whole project in that way, I would feel a sense of weight. this, I could feel my spine bending in the sense of, oh dear, what if I can't do it? What if I do flap, but I plummet? You know, what if I have absolutely no skill at leading or holding responsibility? Or what if? And this tremendous sense of burdenness or pressure or fear of failing or things not working and this blur of anxiety around it. So I pondered that, and then I also considered many of the teachings Ajahn Sumedho had given, and particularly when he often had talked about when he came from Thailand to England back in 1977. He was invited by this group in London to take over a small vihara that they had, and to start a branch monastery, a monastery of Western monks in London. And he was going to bring another three bhikkhus from the Wat Bapong monasteries and start up in London. And what came to mind when I was noticing this feeling of anxiety and pressure and burdenness, something that he'd said over and over again, and I'd heard it in Dhamma talks, but I hadn't really made much of it. And what he said was, when I listened to what other people were expecting of me, and I formed the idea of, it's my job to take the Dhamma to the West. It's my role, my job to carry the true teaching, the Wat Bapong, the Ajahn Chah style of practice, and the true Theravada forest tradition to the West, to introduce this kind of Dhamma practice into England. He said, immediately I feel depressed and lonely and helpless and incapable of doing such a thing. But then when I thought of it in terms of, well, these good people from London have invited me to come and practice the Dhamma, and they've offered me the roof over my head for a night, and they've offered to put alms food in my bowl, in the morning, and so I can do that. I can make use of a shelter. I can be content and glad of the food that they offer. I can do that. That's not difficult at all. And so he realized that when he thought of it in terms of, I've just been invited to come to England to practice the Dhamma, and then if people show up and they want me to talk and they like what they hear, then fine. If they don't show up or they ask me to talk and they don't like what they hear, then well, that's fine too. And just coming here to practice Dhamma, and whatever comes out of it, that's fine. And then he said when he reflected on it in that way, not so much based on self-view, but more just the response to the time and the place, the situation. It was spacious. It was a delightful opportunity. He said, oh, interesting to practice Dhamma in a cold place. Interesting to see what it's like to walk on arms round in the streets of London. It's interesting to be looked at as a weird nutcase, rather than object of reverence by the people of Thailand. So that those teachings that he'd given came to mind. And I thought, am I doing that? what have I been doing with my mind? And I saw that what had been happening was the mind had been grabbing the idea, the project of starting a monastery up over here, totally from the position of self-view. It was all about me, this person who has to go and do this thing, and it's my responsibility, and I've got to be this, and I mustn't be that, and I've got to create this, and I don't want to create that, and it was all I, me. And so I listened to that and reflected on it, and then started to use that same kind of reflection that he had applied when he was invited to England. And just said, well, if people in the States invite me to come and practice there, and they offer to put food in my bowl, offer me shelter, roof over the head for a night, I can do that. That's fine. And I began to see the whole thing as a relinquishment of self-consume, self-concern, or self-view, self-centeredness, rather than a me who is creating something or developing something or becoming something. And even though that there is an effort going on, and there's brochures being printed and places being rented and so on and so forth, the way it's being held is completely different. And so I found exactly as Ajahn Sumedho had done, when I thought of it in that way, when I thought of it as a vanishing, a relinquishment, rather than a development or a becoming or a project that I've got to do, then it was spacious, it was delightful, it was interesting. And the unknown, what it was going to turn into, rather than being frightening or threatening, was mysterious. There was a quality of mystery or wonder and delight rather than terror. So when we look at our own, say, commitment, strengthening the commitment to the precepts, the refuges, becoming an upasika, the upasika development program, developing our own practice, our own commitment, or developing our own centers, or our own groups, whether they happen to be in Canada or in Portland or in Wisconsin or in North Carolina or wherever we might be, Redwood Valley. this is an element that is really crucial to focus on. How are we picking it up? How are we holding the project? Is it about me, or is it about Dhamma? Because the result is very, very different. In Buddhist practice, you learn, usually painfully, that the means and the end are unified. If you use a means based on self and on becoming, on self-view, then that's going to condition the result. Ajahn Sumedho again would often say, if you start off with self-view, if you start off with ignorance, you end up with dukkha. If you start off with vijja, with awareness, with knowing, then the result is nibbana. The result is peace. The result is clarity. So when we think about making a commitment, committing to the three refuges, committing to the five precepts, committing to the upasika program, which involves undertaking to meditate every day, observe, attend to the a retreat once a year, or to observe the lunar days or the new and full moon in some way that's appropriate. And that it's important to pick up that kind of a commitment or training in a way that's free from that self-centered view. One of the very beautiful teachings that a very simple and beautiful teaching that the Buddha gave was, I think it was King Parsenadi one day met the Buddha and said, "How come the disciples of yours, how come they are so bright? How come they look so radiant? They're so at ease. Their countenance is bright and clear. Their minds like the wild deer. The disciples of other ascetics are sort of lean and rare and haggard, and their veins knotted and standing out all over their bodies." These things are always a little bit overinflated in the scriptures. He said, "How come when I look at your students, your disciples, they are clear-eyed and peaceful and at ease and radiant?" And the Buddha said, "They do not dwell on the past, neither do they create, and neither do they concern themselves with anxiety about the future, nor do they create false views or wrong views about the sense of self here in the present moment. Therefore, they are radiant. They don't dwell on the past, they don't become anxious about the future, and don't create ideas about the self here in the present. So that's a very handy little pointer or a way of guiding us how to sustain that quality of attending to the present, attending to our lives and the way we handle our world. Because the more we see things from habits of self-view, then the more time gets concretized, isn't it? I've got my past, my future, my plans. I've got plans. You know, tomorrow I'm supposed to lead a day long at Spirit Rock, and then on Monday I'm supposed to fly to England, and then going off to for a week to some Sangha meetings, and then off for a weekend in Cornwall with my sisters, and then from there to Italy and lead a retreat in Italy and stomp around the Dolomites for a few days, and then back to England, then walking from in a few leaps and bounds the length of England, the long road north revisited adventure, trudge, then back here again in time for the full moon of May. So I've got plans, it's all there. I've got tickets and my name is on various schedules. And, you know, I have a past. You know, we have just telling stories about the foundation of this place. Actually, it was supposed to begin in 92, but it was another few years because other things intervened. But we all have our stories, don't we? We have our past, we have our future, our plans. But the more that we believe in those in a solid and fixed way, we see them as an absolutely firm reality. This is actually what happened. This is what I'm going to do. This is who I am. This is my story. This was a happy time. This was a difficult time. This was a success. This was a failure. This was a really good. This was really bad. This was really mediocre. We create ourselves out of the memories of the past and plans for the future. We project an image of ourselves, who we are, and our story, our saga, off into the past. We project it off into the future. And then we sustain, endeavor most of the time to sustain a particular image or set of ideas about ourselves here in the present. We put forth, we present ourselves in a particular way to the world. You know, when we're introduced to someone, then we will immediately come up with our, you know, our name or where we've come, the place where we've come from, what our occupation is. We create a story, we create an image. But is that completely in the whole picture of who and what we are? Or is it just a patchwork of different ideas or things that the society values? You know, we don't notice how habituated we are to creating that story and believing in it and reinventing it, presenting it to other people. Just today I was listening to a remarkable exposition. A few people have been telling us about this, of a neurologist, a neuroscientist, a woman who gave a talk at the TED conference recently about, she's a neuroscientist who was able to describe having a massive stroke in the left hemisphere of her brain. So she was able to describe her entire rational function shutting down and left with a very clear and fully functioning sort of intuitive side of the brain. And her right brain was going, wow, this is great. The world is just feeling. Everything in the universe is just energy. It's all feeling. Everything is perfect. We're all perfect feeling beings. We're all perfect energy beings, all entirely meshed with each other. How miraculous, how wonderful, how perfect. And then she was describing how every so often there'd be this wave of activity in the left brain saying, this is really weird. I need help. What's going on here? I think I must be having a stroke. And then the left brain would sort of shut down and stop working in the right brain, we go, oh, this is so cool. We are all one. Yes, of course. We are all the energy of the, I am the energy of the universe. And she described how she just lost her story. And during the time of having this stroke, she forgot the whole thing. Who she was, where she was, what she was. She said it was like being an infant in the body of a grown woman. So I'm not promoting the idea of having strokes in order to have a liberating mystical experiences. But these things point to the habits that the mind has and what limitations we create unconsciously within ourselves. And when we notice what the habit is, then we can train ourselves not to be caught in that, and not to buy into that or be limited by that. So when we see that so much of that feeling of burdenedness, of alienation, of anxiety comes from creating a past, creating a future, creating ideas about the self in the present, then we become able to let go, to not create that, to not be limited by that or burdened by that. And that's where the radiance comes from. That's where the brightness of heart, the easefulness comes from. So what I would I'd like to encourage in terms of renewal, it's not just a matter of sort of me renewing myself or me becoming a better self or me undertaking to do better in the future, just on the personal level. Certainly there's a way that's true on a conventional level. But if we hold that in terms of, oh, I was like that in the past, I'm going to be like that in something else in the future, and this is what I am now. If the mind latches onto that, and the more concrete and solid and real we believe that to be, then the more we actually disable the genuine process of maturation, the genuine spiritual development from occurring. Because it's a mysterious and an ironic process that actually the development, true development, spiritual development, comes through relinquishment. It's through that letting go, through non-identification, non-fabrication, not creating that self-view, that identity view. So in a way, it's more of maybe you could call it a renewal, Upasaka renewal day. But it's more of a focusing the attention here and now, to train our attention to awaken to the Dhamma here and now, rather than strengthening the view of I am this person who is so many years old, I was born in this particular place, and I am this age, this name, this gender, this story, these qualifications, these problems, these potentials. And rather, as the Buddha encourages, letting go of the past, letting go of the future, not creating the ideas about the self here in the present moment. Then we find in the mysterious way that's how development happens. That's how there is progress. And there are so many dimensions of our life that this same dynamic occurs, where we're trying to do the right thing. We're trying to be benefiting ourselves or others. And we just don't notice this quality of self-view creeping in and taking over. But isn't it the case? It's always the troublemaker. That when we take things personally, or we want to own something or claim responsibility for something, whether it's a pleasant or a painful thing, that's when it really gets difficult. So to use the meditation and the powers that we have of reflection and investigation to notice that, to look at that quality and see how it arises within our hearts and see how it does slip in and take over. You know, earlier in the week we were discussing the quality of leadership. Now, sometimes we recognize that it's very useful to have someone to lead a group. You know, if someone knows the territory and they are familiar with the environment and the landscape and they've made the journey a number of times before, leadership can be very helpful and just keep things uncomplicated, maintain the direction that everyone wants to go in. Leadership is extremely helpful and beneficial. Everyone can be assisted and supported by skillful leadership. But when that leadership is taken over by that quality of leadership is taken over by self-view, then it becomes controlling, doesn't it? It's like that someone can be a strong leader, but without having to control everybody and everything. When that element of leadership is mishandled, then what happens is that there can be a good intent, an intent to set things in the right direction, an intention to help people along, but it slides into, I know the way it is. I'm going to tell you, I'm in charge here. Do this, don't do that. This is right, that's wrong. And then that those good intentions and that good energy then gets distorted and becomes burdensome. So that I think we all know what it's like to be on the under the influence of a control freak, being told what to do all the time, having every gesture being judged and ordered from above. It's really frustrating, isn't it? Rouses irritation, anger, aversion, almost guaranteed. We don't like to be controlled. But when we're in a situation where someone is a good leader and that there is that strength and energy and knowledge is handled in a skillful way, oh, this is great, this is so marvelous, so and so can pull things together. And we delight in having that that presence to help be a catalyst to help things, to support things, what we're trying to do, to help things along, to be the oil in the wheels that makes it all the task that we're involved in, or the work or the group that we're involved in, makes it all flow along a lot easier. We can carry out what we're aiming to do so much more fluidly and beneficially and enjoyably. So I mean, obviously there's different ways to reflect on this, but there's a huge difference in that, isn't there? But if we don't realize how that works, we don't realize the influence of self-view, then when we try to lead, what we can end up doing is just trying to control and make everything go a particular way. There's no sensitivity, there's no listening involved in that. And we end up with stress and conflict and fragmentation. At least that's my experience of it. So it's helpful to recognize that feeling of I and me and mine, how things should be, how I want it to be, what I think the way you should be and where you're coming from and how I'd like you to behave, and just to see that it's always possible to let go of self-view, or that self-centered perspective. And we can tease those things apart so that it's just in that domain of leadership, that there can be leading, but without that domineering control. Those things can be separate from each other, and how much more pleasant and peaceful, delightful, liberating that is. One of the teachings we were looking at today in the Upasika session was the basic instructions that the Buddha gave right on in the earliest discourses, in the first, second discourse. And in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, which is traditionally known as the second discourse the Buddha gave, he outlines the direct way that we can analyze experience in terms of unsatisfactoriness, uncertainty, or impermanence, and selflessness. So that in terms of cultivating this, a feeling for when self-view is arising, it's really a lot to do with highlighting those feelings of I and me and mine. And in that teaching of the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the Buddha over and over again reiterates this close looking at our experience of the body, feelings, perceptions, thoughts and emotions, consciousness itself, picking them up, looking at them, and asking, is this me? Is this what I am? Is this myself? Is this who and what we are? Does this thought have an owner? Does this feeling have an owner? Is this me? Is this mine? Is this who and what I am? And it takes that kind of close scrutiny that he encourages in that teaching to become aware, to be alert to those habits of drifting into the self-view and seeing things from a self-centered perspective. The current is so strong, the habit is so strong, and that unless we look really closely, we won't see it. It's so normal to buy into those habits of my past, my future, my ideas, who and what I am this person, this is my name, this is my age, this is my address, this is my gender, this is my group, these are my opinions, my beliefs. It's so normal, isn't it? It's totally unremarkable to think in those terms. So that's why the Buddha encourages us, says, look closely, look at it, look. Look now, what is that? That feeling of my body, that my-ness, that I-ness. What is that? What's that based on? Is that true? Is that real? So part of the commitment to the path, the commitment to the Triple Gem, and to really bring these efforts of ours to fruition, it takes that initiative, not just to have that commitment to follow the precepts and the principles involved in the Triple Gem, but to be bringing them alive in the moment. So it's bringing attention to the present, but then in that very attention to this present, looking at this sound, this feeling in the body, this mood, this sensation, and cultivating that kind of close scrutiny and saying, well, what is this? Who owns this thought? Does this mood have an owner? Is this really who and what I am? Where is this happening? So that application of these fundamental wisdom quality in each moment, this is what really liberates us, because just attending to the now, to the here and now, just recognizing this is what's happening now, that's part of it. It's like getting the attention to where reality is. But then if we don't then, in any way, turn up the magnification, we miss the key piece, because there can be a focusing on the present, but still there can be this unconscious solidifying of habits and views. But when we take the trouble and put forth the energy to really apply that insight and say, this is a feeling. Feelings arise and cease. These are not self. Oh yeah, right. It's not that we're inventing an idea or adopting a belief, but we're catalyzing the intuitive wisdom, the knowledge that is already here within our hearts. We know this already. We just miss it because we're too busy with other things. But this turning up the magnification, looking closely, really attending, it's catalyzing, it's igniting that realization in the heart that says, oh yeah, of course. Oh yeah, right. This is just a thought in my mind. This is a mood. This is a sensation. Oh yeah, right. This is a mental event. This is a pattern of consciousness. Oh yeah, right, of course. One of Ajahn Sumedho's favorite themes, like many Dhamma teachers, he'll have a sort of particular set of phrases or ideas or themes that he would use over and over again for a couple of years, and then he'd change to a different one. And many years ago, in the early days of Chithurst Monastery in England, his favorite phrase was, "What is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know?" And then he'd wait for a moment and say, what Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? And the implication being it must be some sort of fantastic and multifaceted, kaleidoscopic, multi-dimensional vision of the universe. He'd say, what Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know is that all that arises passes away and is not self. That's the difference. That's what Buddhas know. And that, as we were referring to in this afternoon in the Upasika session, that the Buddha, having reverence for the Triple Gem, devotion to the Triple Gem isn't just those external qualities of the Buddha as a teacher, as a historical figure, or the Dhamma as the words there in the scriptures, but it's cultivating that devotion to those qualities of our own hearts, that in us which is awake and holy, that in us which is pure and ocean-like in compassion. That quality of buddho, of awareness, of knowing, is a faculty of our own heart, already existent, it's here. And what it knows is that all that arises passes away and is not self. So it's not like an idea that we've invented that we're plastering on the surface of reality, but it's digging into the heart, opening up the heart to uncover that intuition, that's already the fact, that we know this already. Oh, it is just a thought, it is just a mood. It's a flush of delight at success, it's a grinding agony of failure. It's a grumble of boredom at the mediocre. It's a feeling of tiredness, it's a feeling of sweet memory. It's a smell, it's a sound, that's all. Oh yeah, it's a pattern of consciousness, it arises, it ceases. How could this be a person? How could reality be a person? Huh. And then in tapping into that intuition, awakening the heart to that intuition, then letting that, the implications of that, be felt. Just letting that reverberate through the being, through our awareness. Oh yeah. Huh. And in that reverberation, in letting those implications filter through the heart, then there's a letting go. And in that moment, there's freedom, there's liberation, there's ease. Oh yeah. Huh. So from the outside, it might look like we're becoming a more and more accomplished and committed Buddhist, devoted practitioner. But from the inside, it's not me becoming more devoted, me becoming more committed, me becoming more of an anything. But the internal experience is that of relinquishment, of abandonment, of letting go. And it's a mysterious way that it works. But this is how it functions. It's like this is why the Buddha, the Tathagata, is both completely here and completely gone. Thus come, thus gone. As an utter presence and a commitment to the moment. But there's also a complete relinquishment. And it's paradoxical. mysterious how this works, but this is the fact of it, as far as I can see. And in committing ourselves to the path and to the practice, it's committing us our hearts to the realization of that paradox, that how we can be perfect in conduct and knowledge, perfectly attuned and caring of the time and the place and the situation, and perfectly unattached to any attribute that it has. How can that be? How does that work? The left brain gets frustrated. Now, wait a minute, what's going on here? But just like our friend with the stroke, it's like the right brain is saying, yeah, everything is fine. So don't worry if the left brain is left spluttering a bit and can't quite figure it all out or line it all up or make it meaningful or have it all make sense. That's not the mutterings and murmurings, chatterings of the left brain are not the whole story. But also to trust the intuitions of the right brain, the intuition of the heart that knows the Dhamma, that knows the truth of the way things are. And trusting in that and seeing for ourselves the results when we let go, when we really see things clearly and the heart lets go. How does it feel? What is here? And then we let that realization itself, that quality of indisputable peace and ease that comes from that. That's what guides us. That's what informs the heart and points the direction. So I offer these thoughts for consideration. Antamayam gamakataya sadhukaranga dhamma se.